Greetings, crew. This is Yonav speaking on Wednesday, June 6th. And this is an audio file to accompany the next set of crew notes, which would be CN18, under the title Pleuromic Relay. So I haven't produced a set of written notes since the 21st of March, which is over 2 months. I'm writing the notes right now, but I'm doing the audio commentary first, so that will be on Gaia Spora immediately, and you can listen to that actually before you receive the written notes, Crew Notes 18, which are coming your way on Thursday, tomorrow. To begin with this commentary, let me reassure you again that even though I've been out of touch for a while, you really haven't missed a thing. The stall of the lunar apogee before the Satanic Mask of Cetus has been in effect for these 2 months, and it's just now shifting, that is to say, at the rate of about 1 degree every 10 days, the lunar apogee is pulling away from its stall. I wouldn't ever abandon you in such a critical moment of time. And I can assure you that I think constantly every day about the navigation experiment. I live in the experiment as you do. And so although we may be out of touch at moments, and never again for such a long period of time, however, even though we may be out of touch at moments, we are all tracking the same events, and we are all on the crew are in this experiment together. You know, you don't know what you're capable of. It's just something that I want to remind you of. I'm delighted and pleased and thrilled when you discover what you're capable of in my company, when you discover it through what I teach, or simply what I would share through my personal observations and experiences, just as you share your own with me, and just as all members of the crew share our experiences. And I am thrilled and delighted that I am able to perhaps encourage you or direct you in that way. Remember that the role of the Nahual is twofold: to provide syntax and to steady the approach to the unknown. And so in my double role as Nav and Nahual, I'm occasionally able to do this. I must say that the delight I have in being able to act occasionally as a guide is immense and pleases me, and I really enjoy it. I really enjoy teaching. You know, it's my calling. Teaching is a Jupiterian function, and I have an extremely high Jupiter factor in my astrological makeup. But I often reflect on a remarkable fact, which is the marriage of form and void, the complementarity of presence and absence. If on some occasion I can guide you to what you're capable of, especially something that you didn't know you were capable of, I also have the pleasure of knowing that you can guide yourself there, that you can do it in my absence as well as in my presence. This is a great joy for me. It's a great vindication, you could say, a satisfaction a fulfillment of what I've attempted to do throughout my life in my actions as a teacher. So I want to thank you all for sticking with me through the moment that I wasn't there. And I want to point out that freedom is a runaway train. I don't know if you've seen that film. It's a movie. Runaway Train. It's a movie with John Voight and Eric Roberts and Rebecca De Mornay. And it's directed by a Russian. And get a hold of that movie if you can. Rent it or download it and watch it. You might enjoy it or you might not. It has a considerable degree of what might be called violence and brutality in it, especially in the main character, Manny, who's played by John Voight, the escaped convict. But in a way, I'm somewhat like Manny, and certainly if we found ourselves in a difficult situation, physically together in this world, I might be in some respects like Manny. It's very compelling to watch what happens in that story of Runaway Train. And so, if you like watching movies, you might take a peek at it. But the point I'm making here is that freedom is a runaway train. And on that train, a lot of things can happen. And in the spontaneity of facing those things, in the challenge of facing those things, you realize what you're really capable of. You know what you can do. And it's always beyond what you thought you could do. Always. So anyway, I'm going to dedicate this audio commentary to a recapitulation of Crunote 17, which went out under the title 2012 Recall, I think. It also had a subtitle, Sophia's Recapitulation, a Provisional Linear Sequence. Now, I just reread this. I haven't read it since I sent it out. It's extremely rough notes with a kind of a timetable and not particularly coherent or not, certainly not too user-friendly. So I'm going to go over Crunote 17 and recapitulate it so that we can have some continuity here as we segue into Crunote 18, which is titled Pleromic Relay. But before I start the recapitulation, I'd like to deliver two pieces of really, really good news regarding how correction is unfolding. All of you know by now that the Sophianic vision story, which is a cosmological myth of things that really happened, contains a number of anomalous and unanticipated events. We feel empathy, those of us who participate in that story and live in it, feel empathy for the main character of that story, because she, the wisdom goddess, the Aeon Sophia, had to face unpredicted and unanticipated events. And in one particular case, when her organic light, currents of organic light, torrents of organic light that make Niagara Falls look like the strands of hair on the head of a young child. In one case, she faced a moment of real terror and fear, which was completely unknown, is completely unknown in the experience of aeons. And out of that moment of stark terror she materialized as a kind of thought form, to use an old theosophical term, the creature whom we know as Mantis. So other events as well took place. The emergence of the Archons was an unanticipated event. The shearing of the Anthropos template, which caused the division of the sexes, and eventually many, many untold eons of time later induced the human species into mitotic reproduction. These were momentous events that happened in the course of Sophia's cosmic adventure. And it's both a delight and a privilege to know these events, to know about these events, and to follow how Sophia handled them. There is, however, one event that is taking place now that could only have occurred due to a succession of previous anomalous events. Mainly, the event through which Sophia herself, as an aeon from the Palomic Center, came to be embodied in a planet. So the planet Earth is her body, her planetary body, although she still retains her primary substance body, which is the pleromic form of the organic light. She is both in her pleromic form and in her planetary form, present to you right now, constantly, every moment you are alive. She is present. You live in her presence in this dual mode of existence that she's assumed. Now, the story tells us that it's a massive anomaly that she would have become metamorphosed into a planet, the living planet we call Gaia. Okay, and what a challenge that is for her to handle that embodiment. But at the same time, due to that very fact, due to the very conditions of her embodiment, which were unanticipated, she is able to do something with the divine experiment unfolding on Earth that she could not otherwise have done. She's able to do something that she could not possibly have done had she remained in the pleromic core with the other aeons, such as Christos and Thelete. And what is that? Well, in a word, it's recalibration. Now, when pleromic aeons design a sentient life form, such as the Anthropos, they calibrate the constituent elements of that proposed entity, that proposed organism, or genomic life form. They calibrate the components as Sophia and Thelete did in the pleromic core prior to and independent of anything happening in the galactic limbs. But once that calibrated genome, that calibrated template is projected into the galactic limbs, seeded, as it were, the common or the modern term being panspermia, they can't recalibrate it. Once the experiment is on in one or another planetary world where the particular creature takes root, where it assumes its emergent existence, they don't mess with the primal formula, as it were, because the interest of the aeons is how that creature, how that organic life form will evolve and develop on its own terms. They don't want to mess with the experiments. That's not interesting to them. It's much more interesting to, and much more consistent with their generosity as aeons, to let the experiment unfold on its own terms. But look at what's happening here right now. The divine Sophia is actually able to recalibrate the human genome from within this experiment going forward from correction. Just take a moment and think about that. Take that on board. Consider what that means.
Oh, and that is, needless to say, it's quite a momentous prospect. And it bodes very well for the ultimate fate of the Anthropos in this current laboratory setting, in this current planetary setting, the Gaian habitat. It bodes very well. It means that even though Anthropos 10 might be crapping out, to use a crude term, even though Anthropos 10 might have degenerated to the point where it cannot be saved, she can recalibrate the germ plasm of the anthropic species right here and now within the experiment and produce the initial specimens of Anthropos 11. And that is exactly what she's doing. And to add a second fantastic notion to that fantastic prospect, we in the Gaia Navigation Experiment can not only observe how she is recalibrating the Anthropos, but we can be part of the recalibration. We can be in the process of mutation, what I termed years ago, transspeciation. We can place ourselves in the process of transspeciation, which is the transition from Anthropos 10, the state of the human genome as it entered the current Kalpa about 26,000 years ago, and Anthropos 11, the state of the human genome as it departs from this Kalpa and moves through the apparent trajectory of linear time into the coming Kalpa, which begins in about 204 years. So this is really fantastic, and we can observe how the Divine Sophia is recalibrating the Anthropos by the position and activity of the perigee surges. So I'm due very soon to give extremely close attention to the perigee surges. Up until now, I've emphasized the apogee surges, representing divine memory, but the perigee surges, representing divine alchemy, are going to become tremendously and vividly obvious as the lunar perigee shifts into the scorpion in the course of 2012. How exciting is that? Second good news is that since the inception of correction in March of 2011, Sophia has resumed a two-way signaling system with the Pleroma. She is in contact again. She has come out of the autistic capture of her second attention by the preoccupations of her planetary body. And she has broken through and sent a signal, an initial signal, back to the Pleroma in March 2011. And the Pleroma now is signaling to her. The distance from the Earth to the Pleromic Center is about 25,000 light years. But in pleromic terms, takes very little time for those signals to pass back and forth. It's interesting. So let me point this out. This is what I call something I've observed in studying the ancient zodiacs, such as Dendera, what I call space-time conversion. Sometimes numbers that apply to space convert over to numbers that apply to time or cycles of time, and vice versa. Well, the number that applies to space, and these are just numbers, this is just a provisional syntax, something that you can use roughly to train your NLP for more sophisticated realizations. It's said to be about 25, 26,000 years from our position, the position of the solar system in the third galactic limb, to the center of the galaxy. Well, curious, isn't it, that 25, 26,000 years is also the length of a kalpa. And so now I'm going to really juggle with your mind as if I were a juggler juggling grapefruits and lemons. And you might enjoy this, you might find it specious, and you might find it delightful. But the time-space conversion of 25,000 light years to 25,000 years is not just a game, but it is a juggling of the coordinates of space and time and of the dynamic components of space and time. It's a real conversion. And in that real conversion, the dynamic laws, or what we call the dynamic laws of physics, are entirely melt away. And as they do, the real dynamics of the cosmos manifest. What am I getting at here? Well, recall the analogy that one kalpa of 25,920 years is, for the Aeon Sophia, the equivalent of a day. We are now in the last 11 minutes of one day. One day for the Divine Sophia. 26,000 years for human beings. And just as I can say, just as I can assert that equivalence, a day to 26,000 years, I can tell you how long does it take for the Divine Sophia to send a signal 26,000 light years. It only takes a day. Now, it sounds outrageous and totally against the known laws of physics, because the signals that she is sending are acoustic. Yeah, they are acoustic signals. They are like a special kind of ELF wave. They are special ELF wave transmissions, extra low frequency, going back and forth like whale songs between the Earth and the pleromic center. And even though the speed of sound is only what it is, what, 728 miles per hour, we're told? Something like that. It only takes the sound a day to go 25,000 light years. Now you feature that. That doesn't juggle around a few grapefruits and lemons in your mind, I don't know what will. Here I need to correct myself. I just said human beings. I mean, of course, human animals. And I also mean that the time that it takes for the Divine Sophia to transmit one of her acoustic signals to the Pleroma is 24 hours in the time of human animals, even though the signal must travel 26,000 light years at the speed of sound. That's a riddle, but this is actually how it's done. So, this is what has been happening
since March of last year. And the good news, the second piece of good news, is that right now, at this moment, June of 2012, the back and forth signaling, the back and forth communication has developed to the point where the pleuromic aeons are able to send out a relay band, a massive relay band to the Pleiades, and from the Pleiades serving as a spindle to the Earth. So what the pleuromic aeons are able to do now, and what they are doing in a timing that is observable in with the parameters of this experiment, is that they are setting up a situation for Gaia Sophia where she would have the Earth on a Pleiadian spindle linkage the way that it ought to have been done initially. But let's recall in the FGS 2.0 expansion of episode 4 of her story that she conceived in trimorphic protonoia of a custom-made planetary system for Anthropos 10. But she was not able to produce a custom-made system because she did not know, as the elder aeons know, the technique of using the spindle of the Pleiades for that particular achievement, for that particular accomplishment of cosmic ordering. So what the aeons are doing now is that they are establishing for her the correct and proper relationship between the pleroma and a custom-made planetary habitat. How do we in the Gaia Navigation Experiment trace that development? The establishment of pleuromic relay? It's simple. It's utterly simple. We do it by observing three key moments, one of which has already transpired, one of which is due in about a week, and the third of which is due in the first week of September. The first moment is when Jupiter converges with the apogee of the moon. That was on April 13th, and the position of convergence was, as you all well know, right there before the satanic head of Cetus, in 16 degrees of the sign Taurus, that is 46 degrees of the ecliptic, in the constellation of the Ram. That was the first moment when the pleuromic aeons began to coordinate with Sophia to bring about a complete relay system for her. Interestingly, that moment was Friday the 13th of April 2012. The next moment is due in about 10 days, and that would be Saturday, June 16th. At that moment, Jupiter reaches the Pleiades. But have you note, by the way, write down in the little yellow square to put on your fridge, three key positions in the ecliptic indicated by the conventional method of reference to the astrological signs, but of course it's really ecliptic degrees of longitude. Ecliptic longitude of the Pleiades is 61, or 1 degree of Gemini. Ecliptic longitude of Aldebaran in the Eye of the Bull is 70, 10 degrees of Gemini. And the ecliptic longitude of the Crab Nebula, which stands just off the star marking the lower horn tip of the bull, is 26 Gemini, or 86 degrees of ecliptic longitude. Memorize those 3 degrees. The
Pleiades is easy to remember. Pleiades is not located on the ecliptic, but every star and every Pleiades is an open star cluster. Every celestial object, such as a nebula or an open star cluster, has an alignment to the ecliptic. So the ecliptic alignment of the Pleiades is 1 degree Gemini. Jupiter reaches this point on Saturday the 16th of June, 2012. That is the second moment in the arrangement of complete pleromic relay for the divine Sophia. Remember that to achieve this relay, the aeons are signaling daily, 24 hours for a signal to go out, 24 hours for a signal to come back to the Earth. They are signaling daily with the Earth. There's a continual back and forth, like two ships signaling in semaphore or in Morse code across the waters. But at the same time, the pleromic aeons are laying out a line. What is the particular nature of this line? Something that I can explain in more detail quite soon. But they're laying out a banded plasmic emanation, a very particular kind of plasmic braid. And these braids do exist in plasma. They've been noted by the Electric Universe people. Plasma has a tendency to braid. They're laying out a braid toward the spindle of the Pleiades. It's going through the spindle mechanism and coming toward the Earth. The indication of the setup of this relay is therefore indicated, observed from activities around the Pleiades. The third moment, which signifies the completion of relay, is the first week of September 2012, when the apogee of the moon attains the ecliptic longitude of the Pleiades, or 1 degree of Gemini. Now, these are, needless to say, momentous events in the history of our planet, in the history of the Anthropos, in any of its kalpas on this planet. And these are, as well, unprecedented events in the cosmic history that is accessible to the range of the human mind. And I would say to you, members of the crew, the same thing that I say to myself. What a challenge it is to imagine what is. Not to imagine what could be, not to imagine what isn't, not to imagine what might be, but to imagine what actually is. Can you imagine that this is actually happening? I first glimpsed this event in March under the Venus-Jupiter conjunction. And as you know, shortly after that magnificent conjunction, the meeting of the guru or guide and the Hetaira, shortly after that, Venus the Hetaira proceeded quite quickly to the house of the seven sisters, which is the Pleiades. So already at that time, my attention and my storytelling second attention, my first attention of observation and my storytelling second attention of imagination were keen on observing the Pleiades. And I have to say that in all of my entire life, I have never faced a greater challenge than to imagine what is due to happen on this planet once pleromic relay is established. That is to say, once the aeons, including Christos
and thelete who play very specific and unique roles in the relay process. Establish for the divine Sophia what she could not have established for herself, what she did not establish for herself upon initiating the experiment with Anthropos 10. Given that she is provided with the conditions that she could not provide herself, given that she has the opportunity to align the custom features of this planetary experiment to the experience of the Anthropos as she originally intended, who can imagine what's going to happen when that relay comes into play? Of course, this is the subject of the moment. This is the subject to dream. This is the subject to dance, to talk about, to discuss, to ponder, to study. This is, in my estimation, as a creative mythologist, the supreme opportunity of human imagination to realize the optimal development of this experiment on her terms, on her original terms. So put it in your own words. I know you all can. Put it in your own words. Speak it. Say it out loud. Paraphrase it in your own way, what this event is and what it signifies. Do that and do it over and over again. And let yourself be seized by the power of this story. This is actually happening cosmically right now to the planet and to those people who participate in her life and follow her story. And how wonderful is that? Now, in concluding that sublime consideration, and it really is sublime, it's breathtaking. I'd like to offer just a little bit of professorial advice, as it were, or just give you a little nudge as the teach. There are certain things that you can study right now and in the course of this summer that would greatly enhance your ability to take on board this momentous event and to realize in your own life and in the life of the planet what it really means, what it entails, and where it's taking us. So for suggested reading, I would say most definitely read Wilhelm Reich. Study about Reich. Look at the YouTube documentaries about him. And read The Function of the Orgasm, of course, but also his last published book, Ether, God, and Devil, Cosmic Superimposition. Read that, and also read and research into the subject of animal magnetism and the life and work of Anton Mesmer, which actually corresponds historically to the moment in time when Sophia originally woke or broke into the consciousness of lucid dreaming, that is to say around the time of the French Revolution. I've been talking quite a bit about Mesmer with a couple of people lately, and I just want to point out to you all that the breakthrough of Anton Mesmer, the discovery of animal magnetism, and the manipulation of this magnetism for healing and erotic purposes and for psychic purposes as well as physical purposes is closely parallel to Wilhelm Reich's discovery of orgone, of course. But Mesmer was a couple of centuries or more earlier Had the work of Mesmer not been destroyed and repressed, had Mesmer himself not been sabotaged and represented as a charlatan, had the human animal been able to continue in continuity from the discoveries of Anton Mesmer, and had the human animal been able to expand, and extrapolate the physics of animal magnetism, life on this planet today would be very, very different than it has turned out to be. In fact, Mesmer's work and the discovery of the psychodynamics and the erotic and hygienic potency of animal magnetism, that is to say, the electrodynamics of the planetary animal mother herself, all of that is the right course for Anthropos. Anthropos 10 didn't follow that course, but Anthropos 11 follows that course. So, in the calibration, the recalibration, or as I call it, the transpeciation that Sophia is now accomplishing, the work and science and vision of Anton Mesmer stands as a central and focalizing intel for the future of this species. And I cannot emphasize that too strongly. In the same vein, regarding the studies and research and reflections that are appropriate for the immense cosmological developments underway, I would also advise that you look into the electric universe theory. There is a YouTube channel called Thunderbolts Project, which has talks on the electric universe. Now, I think that the electric universe people have stumbled a bit in getting their program going. They've made some initial errors. They're still establishing the initial conditions of this new science. I would say happily that the period of time in our history when the initial conditions of correction are set is exactly the period of time when the initial conditions of the electric universe or plasma cosmology are being defined. And so far there have been some errors, and they've stumbled and they've flubbed a few points. I should probably do a single nav briefing on this subject. But lately they seem to be getting into gear, and some of the things they're saying lately in their lectures, especially in the 2012 conference of the electric universe, is brilliant. It's clear, it's lucid, it's cogent, and it's going dead center in the direction of Sophianic cosmology and Gaian physics. And it shall converge. It shall converge. I pronounce this proposition that if plasma cosmology and the electric universe theory, EUT, is to succeed and assume its true form, it must incorporate the complementary factors in the Sophianic vision story. The two things are made for each other. They're made for each other. They're complementary. And I look forward to seeing this happen and perhaps even to contributing to it in some small manner. In that vein, a book that you might want to read, which is actually recommended, cited by one of the leading plasma theory scientists, is The Body Electric, Electromagnetism and the Foundation of Life, by Robert O. Becker and Gary Selden. I'm just peeking right now into the index of that book, and I see that there is, on one page, 243, a reference to Franz Anton Mesmer. Not more than that. But you see, this is just the beginning, and it's just coming together. And if the electric universe people have got their heads on straight, And if they have said their prayers to Gurdwara, have done a bit of morphological thinking, and are able to stay in their bodies and observe their senses as Reich advised, they will certainly come around to the point where they realize that Anton Mesmer is an important scientist and contributor to the realm of the electric universe and the electric planet. And on that note, just want to say, just want to impart to you, transmit to you, a piece of intel, piece of Gaian intel. I'm going to use this term now for my shamanic investigations and my shamanic discoveries. Gaian intel, okay? I received a piece of Gaian intel quite spontaneously up on the hill under the full moon at around 4 a.m. a few nights ago. Several pieces of intel, actually. I've spoken of this moment when Gaia informed me of her understanding of the historical process that we're in, which she did through speaking through the Ratama, or the wonderful, supple reeds that fill this valley where I live. And I've reported what she said in another briefing. Obviously, there's a lot more to say about it. But she has a funny way of talking to me, you know. First of all, she sounds like Jessica Rabbit. You know that film, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Now, I've said this before, that Gaia speaks to me in the voice of Jessica Rabbit. And I'd just like to point out a really important factor in that outrageous statement. Jessica Rabbit is a cartoon character, and the voice provided for the cartoon is from Kathleen Turner, who was at various moments in her life a fairly sexy actress. Body Heat, for instance. But I'm not saying that Gaia speaks to me in the voice of Kathleen Turner, because she really speaks in the voice of Jessica Rabbit. And it's a sultry voice. And it's low and a bit hoarse. And that's the tone of it. Soft and hoarse. Sultry. But the manner in which she speaks is peculiar to her, peculiar to the planetary animal mother. That is to say that she doesn't waste words. She speaks extremely cogently, in extremely compressed language, which is typical of Dakini syntax. And that sometimes she appears to throw out a remark. I can't put it in any other way. She just appears to throw out a remark out of nowhere. That's to say, oh, by the way, I think you might like to know this. And guess what? She threw out a remark. I'll paraphrase how it came down. And then I'll quote exactly what the remark was. Oh, yeah, I might, it might interest you to know this. How life is defined in the mind of an aeon. Would you like to know that? Would you like to know, in the syntax and language of the human animal, particularly in the language of English, but it could be in any of hundreds of languages, but it was put into English because it was put into my brain. So would you like to know in English how an aeon defines life?
Well, you might like to know. And so here it is. Quote, electrified animation of colloids, unquote. This is it. This is exactly what she said, and there's no the in the syntax. She said, repeat, quote, life is electrified animation of colloids, unquote. That is as life is regarded from the aeonic point of view. So just reflect on that. Just leave you with that little snippet of Gaian intel. Drop it into your mind. Suck it down your first attention and brew it in your second attention in the alembical matrix of your imagination and see what comes out of it. It's the most fruitful little passing remark from the divine Shakti of the earth. The most fruitful little remark. So, to conclude now, I'll just run through the printout I have here of Crew Notes 17. I noted on the second page that we could expect a massive rush of the dreaming attention, but not during the time that the stall was in effect. So as I said, the apogee goes into a stall for 3 months, and during that time, the wisdom goddess engages in her most intense dismantling of the binding structure of the archontic spell and mass mind control. And now, as the lunar apogee shifts away from the stall, the power of archonic mind control dissolves like a mist before your very eyes, or before your very mind. Or, to add another simile, it dissolves like breath on a mirror. Actually, breath on a smoking mirror. A smoking mirror. Do you know what that is? It's the magical tool. Hey, Nikki. It's the magical tool of Tezcatlipoca. Tezcatlipoca. Tezcatlipoca was an Aztec shaman known as the Lord of the Smoking Mirror. And I've had some... I really don't know how to say some of these things that happened to me. I've had some inklings about Tezcatlipoca lately. And one of the inklings tells me that this is a figure who is due to come into some prominence over the next few months leading up to the end of 2012, leading up to December 2012. I just might point out that a certain city gent that I've met a few times wrote a book on 2012 called The Return of Quetzalcoatl. Suggested in that book, I don't know if he meant to suggest it literally or simply, or metaphorically, or simply as a poetic fiction, but he suggested that he was either the channel of or reincarnation of Quetzalcoatl, who was also an Aztec shaman. And that statement or claim is, on the face of it, a ridiculous one, because Quetzalcoatl does not return in 2012. Quetzalcoatl already returned, just as the Toltec shamans had predicted that the Aztecs were under a curse put on them by the Toltecs. And due to that curse, they suffered a very severe psychosis, not so different from the psychosis of the globalist predators today. And in that psychosis, it is said, usually, that they mistook Cortez and these syphilitic Spaniards, conquistadors, who marched into Tenochtitlan, across the bridge, one starry night, mistook these seedy characters for the prophecy of the Toltecs, consistent with that prophecy, which was a setup intended to bring about the downfall of the Aztecs, Montezuma and his inbred court of elite nobles, fatally mistook Cortez for the returning Quetzalcoatl. So anyone who understands that story as it's truly written knows that it's ridiculous to expect a return of Quetzalcoatl in 2012, because that happened already like 500 years ago, okay? However, what about the return of Tezcatlipoca? Well, you know, there was a magical battle between these two shamans, Tezcatlipoca, Lord of the Smoking Mirror, and Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent. I describe that battle in my book, Twins in the Double, because it's connected with twin motifs. And, well, I don't have to tell you who won that battle. It wasn't Quetzalcoatl, that's for sure. Now, there's a lot to learn from Tezcatlipoca. All I want to say right now is that, well, let me put it this way. How about I do a second audio commentary to go along with Crew Notes 18, which I'm currently writing. The subject of these Crew Notes, as I've said, is the fantastic feat of Pleromic Relay through the Pleiades, which is currently underway. That in itself is quite something for the human imagination to reach, to attain, as I've said. But there's more. Oh, yeah. There's so much more. And I guess I should do part two for this audio commentary to give myself a chance to elaborate a little bit in a casual and lighthearted fashion, of course, on certain arcane developments which are due to occur in the human psyche and perhaps even in the real-world scenario of human animals. Certain arcane events connected with reincarnation, or what is supposed or alleged to be reincarnation. Have you ever wondered about reincarnation? Well, pretty soon, there will be a chance to realize what reincarnation is in a way that has never, ever before been realized. And this is part of the human side, the human participation in the massive cosmic and cosmological developments of Pleromic Relay. Difference between the first half of correction and the second is that in the first half, up until August 2012, we in the Gaian navigation experiment, nav and crew alike, are mainly witnesses to her Nawal. But in the second half, we are actors in her Nawal, participants, agents in the Nawal of the Wisdom Goddess. You might recall that I used the term double orchestration. Let's say that I'll make this the title of part two of my audio commentary to accompany Crew Notes 18. Give me a chance to talk a little bit about the double orchestration of the Divine Sophia and how we of the Gaia Navigation Experiment can be engaged with it. And how, in magical fact, we can be engaged in a kind of double orchestration ourselves. I certainly am. It's not something I can easily put in words. So it would be appropriate to take some more time, finish the recapitulation of the remaining pages of Crew Note 17. Well, I'll take my time to do that. And as I'm doing so, as I'm sashaying along in the second attention, I might just bring up the subject. I might just introduce you to Tetzcalipoca. Tetzcalipoca has something for you. It's a mudra. Now, this is Kalika mudra, but it's something that members of the crew could easily adopt and use. It's called a mudra of passage. I'll take some photographs, show you what it looks like, and I'll include that. It's a little gift from Tetzcalipoca in the second part of this audio commentary. So hang on to your cookies. It's all coming your way. I'll post this today and bring out the second part tomorrow as I send out the crew notes. Also tomorrow, June 7th, I'm going to be opening the Navigator's Mail, which I haven't looked at for about 6 weeks. So bear with me there. Allow me to sort through that material. And rather than write you responses, perhaps I'll just respond in the course of the next recording. That would certainly be easier and probably a lot of fun. Okay, crew, thanks again for sticking with me. You're a faithful bunch of snot-nosed kids sailing in a wooden tub through the Straits of Magellan. And the main thing in this journey, no matter what you learn, just enjoy it. And I'll get back to you soon.